You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And welcome into a Wednesday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We've been getting a lot of questions about it recently on Twitter. So if you aren't aware, because I always say it at the end of shows instead of the beginning of shows, we have moved podcast platforms from Audioboom to Panoply. So now we're uploading them on Megaphone, but you don't really have to know about that. Essentially, you should be getting your Locked On Nets podcast in the same place, I assume most people just use the podcast app on their phone or just go directly to iTunes, and it'll still be right there if for whatever reason you listen online. Hey, no judgment. I do it at work all the time. You can just go directly to the Panoply site. You Google Locked On Nets. That should be the first thing that comes up. Or better yet, go to our Twitter page because we have it linked there. And now I welcome in, later than ever in the intro, Josh Bass. Josh, how's it going?
Gavin, we're taking our talents to Panoply. Is that still a relevant basketball reference, or am I too outdated?
Have I told you one of my coworkers was there for the decision?
Oh no, he was one of the Chicago Boys and Girls Club or Cleveland Boys and Girls Club.
No, because it was like I don't know. I gotta go back and ask for details, and I probably should have before getting into the story. But he's just from Connecticut, and I think he just had like a friend that worked for ESPN or something. He had some kind of connection, and he got in there and he took a pretty cool picture of him at like age like 13 with Kanye West, who was there for some reason.
Okay, yeah, definitely try to corroborate that story for me because something's a little amiss.
Okay, all right, I'm going to go back and ask for every single detail. But yeah, we got to watch a live Nets basketball for the first time this season since you lied about going to the game this weekend. But we got to go watch the Nets take on the Suns. We got excellent upper row seats for the cheap price of $7. It was an empty arena, but I had a great time.
It wasn't that empty. I think it filled up towards the end, and then definitely New York's a kind of a late arriving crowd, if they do arrive at all. And I think that obviously it being Halloween, you're not going to get a great crowd, but it was turned out to be a fun game. Obviously the Nets lost, which was disappointing, but they made it close and they took the lead at some points, which was really the highlight of my evening.
Yeah, it was. I don't know. Maybe I should give the Suns a little bit more credit because if you actually, I mean, it's only four games, so it's hard to read too much into it. And teams always get kind of a bump when they have a new coach. But as we're recording, they're actually about to beat the Washington Wizards, who were up by 20 earlier in the game and had a 32-15 first quarter lead. And then now the Suns are 4-1 since Jay Triano took over, and all their advanced metrics are really good. So maybe the Suns are a little bit better than I'm giving them credit for, but I don't know. Neither team really looked good in the first half, and it seemed like if the Nets had been playing the basketball they played in the first couple games of the year, they would have been up by quite a bit, and instead both teams were kind of middling. The Suns took like a 16-point lead in the third quarter. Nets went on a 22-2 run, took it right back, and then the Suns just kind of grinded the game out in the fourth quarter, and the Nets couldn't really get anything going on either end.
Yeah, the defining part of the game was when Spencer Dinwiddie came out with about 6 minutes left. The Nets had an 8-point lead up until that point, and you can't blame Kenny Atkinson for taking out Dinwiddie because he would have played the last 18 minutes of the game or so. So he needs a rest. I think the way you can fault was not calling a timeout as the 8-point lead evaporated and Dinwiddie still sat on the bench for 2 or 3 minutes. He needs to see that momentum is being lost and call a timeout to insert the catalyst of that run back into the game.
Yeah, I think we were gonna say this for later, but our core takeaway for both of us for the game was how much better the team was when Spencer Dinwiddie was in versus D'Angelo Russell. And this is something that I think a lot of people noticed watching the game. I know Ryan Russillo on his podcast had a whole like rant about it today and just talking about how D'Lo's numbers were kind of empty. And if you just looked at the box score, you'd say D'Lo played, frankly, an incredible game. In only 29 minutes, he scored 33 points and 6 rebounds, 4 assists, 11 of 21 from the field, 2 of 5 from 3, 9 of 11 from the charity stripe. But he did a lot of the little things wrong, and I think those kind of add up, and they take a toll on his teammates. Like, his defense was just utterly atrocious, and and that was true even on like big plays. Like, when the Suns had the ball with a chance to go up by 5 in the final minute, like, D'Lo let, I think it was Devin Booker, just go right by him and then was just kind of chasing the play from behind, but wasn't really doing so with any particular urgency. And you kind of contrast that with Dinwiddie, who was the fulcrum of that comeback, and he's just hitting shots, he's hustling for rebounds, he's boxing guys out, he's using his body to create positioning under the basket. And I think the biggest difference between the two, though, is Dinwiddie kind of sees it as his job to initiate offense, while D'Lo kind of takes it on himself to be the offense and just kind of hijacks possessions while Dinwiddie gets the ball moving.
I agree with that. I think that as I told you during the game, D'Lo, his defense just go for the steal and then just kind of be lethargic and kind of get taken out of the play. And Mike James had a career night against the Nets, scored 24 points. And he looks like a really good player. A great find by Phoenix's front office and Ryan McDonough. So
hey.
One of the few things that McDonough's done right recently.
Yikes.
So credit to Mike James for knocking down those shots. But at the same time, D'Angelo Russell needs to have more intensity. And then on the offensive end, I feel like he predetermines whether he's going to pass or shoot. There's no like reading or reacting to what's happening around him.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, this has been something that we've gone back and forth on throughout the season. And I've seen plays and moments where I'm frankly stunned by D'Angelo Russell's vision and maybe even more so his execution on throwing those passes and his ability to hit guys at weird and unconventional angles and almost bend the ball at points when he's passing it. And he's someone I'd put into that category with a James Harden, with LeBron James, of being kind of geniuses in that category. But at the same time, that makes it all the more confusing where he just can't or refuses to make simple reads and simply initiate the offense. And it's like he has this gift and he just doesn't use it all the time because he feels like he has to be this ISO scorer that I don't think Kenny Atkinson is asking him to be. And it's a skill that should be used maybe when a shot clock is winding down or you're in with backups, and he feels like he has to do it every single possession.
Russell's 100% the most talented player on the team. No one can deny that. But it's kind of like, let's say four guys always play together and they're playing pickup and they're running fives full court. So they have to pick up a fifth guy who's a point guard. And that fifth guy thinks he's better than anyone on the team. So he wants to try to do it all himself. That's what Russell's like right now. But if you have a bit of a lesser player like Dinwiddie, who's comfortable playing with the other guys and getting the ball moving and making sure that people are cutting and actually being in a system where people want to play with you, I think that's going to lead to a more successful team. So I think there needs to be a way that Russell and Dinwiddie can share the court more, just so that takes some responsibility off Russell's back. But also when he's in the game, he has to have a better balance of when he's going to look for a shot and when he's going to look to pass the ball and get teammates involved.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that has kind of manifested itself in each of their plus minuses on the season. Josh, I know you live in 2017, so you just actually looked up their net rating. I went through every single game and went through their just their straight up box score. Not even their box score plus minus, because that's actually an advanced statistic, but just their literal plus minus for every game. And it added up to Dinwiddie in less minutes was a plus 26 on the season. So that's about 3 points a game. D'Lo in more minutes, a minus 68, or about negative 8.5 points a game when he's on the court.
Yeah, so just to kind of put that in advanced statistics, which I hope you guys, as very smart Nets fans, enjoy. Dinwiddie has a net rating of plus 13 on the season, which means the Nets outscore opponents by 13 more points per 100 possessions when he's on the court, while D'Angelo Russell's net rating is negative 9, and it's just been a stark contrast, especially on defense.
Yeah, that's a much better way of summing it up, and I probably could have saved myself a little bit of time by just going to Basketball Reference, but I don't know.
And don't get us wrong, Russell's had a very good season. His PR is at 22. His true shooting percentage, which was very poor, below league average, especially for his position in the first 2 years, is up to 56%, which is very respectable. He's taking threes. He's hitting his shots while getting to the line a little bit more than I expected. So he's basically doubled his free throw rate, which is all great signs for his development. He kind of needs to harness that into more of a team perspective and helping the team win, as opposed to just individual stats at this point.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I remember asking on a podcast, I think it was about a week ago, why the
Lakers. A week ago.
Why the Lakers didn't just keep D'Lo and take someone like Jason Tatum at the with the number three pick, and no, the number two pick in the draft, with the number two pick in the draft. And I was kind of saying that, like, him and Lonzo, just in terms of raw basketball ability, actually have pretty similar skill sets. And you can argue D'Lo's is maybe even a little bit better. And I know that's going to be blasphemous to some people, but just he kind of has the same, maybe not quite the same vision as Lonzo, but I'd say he's pretty close in terms of raw passing ability and the ability to kind of see plays a few seconds before they happen and set their teammates up. And then he's way further along as a scorer and as a shooter than Lonzo is, and they're both pretty bad defensively. But I think in saying that, I didn't really appreciate the effect that Lonzo has on his teammates versus the effect that D'Lo has on his teammates, because Lonzo is kind of the total opposite of everything we've said about D'Lo. It's almost like if you put Dinwiddie's brain with D'Lo's talent, you get something like Lonzo.
Better than Lonzo. Come on.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, he's like a guy whose, like, whole mentality is like, I don't want to be holding the ball for a long time. Like, the second I touch it, I want to be touch passing it to someone else. And you even saw that last night where he had a rebound and it kind of looked like he had a chance for an easy putback, but he just tipped it over to Brook Lopez to give him a layup. And that's the attitude, and that's the execution of that attitude that I think make your teammates love you and make your teammates play harder for you. And you would normally say that's not something that's quantifiable, but I think if you look at Dinwiddie's plus minus and you look at Russell's plus minus, and if you look at why everyone expects Lonzo to be so good and think he's so good, that's kind of a tangible quality almost.
I think that the difference is that Lonzo always makes the correct pass. It could be 20 on the shot clock, but he sees something that could happen 15 seconds down the road. So he's always going to make the pass that's going to set the team up to score in the possession, while D'Lo, a lot of his passes, his great passes, are for assists, and he's really just holding onto the ball and just dribbling, wasting the clock away if he doesn't see something directly that's going to lead to a potential assist.
Yeah, he's kind of that. No, I agree with you. I was even like, I was talking about it with some coworkers today, and I was describing him. He's like kind of like a selfish passer. Like he'll throw it when he's going to get a statistic. And I don't think that was.
I don't know if it's deliberate. I don't think it's deliberate at all. I just think that he doesn't see the game like you would want your point guard to, and that's why a lot of people are saying that he might be more of a natural shooting guard.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm torn on that because it's almost, maybe just like how you worded it, because I don't know if it's seeing the game, because I think his like vision is very good. To me, it really comes down to mentality. And I know that like implies that it's like a conscious thing. And I don't know if it is. That's like, I think that's probably how he played his whole career. And it's kind of amazing that there are unselfish superstars in the NBA. And I think that to me is the most incredible thing about LeBron, that throughout his whole life, he was always the most talented guy on any court he was on. And he still turned into a guy whose mentality is, I want to get my teammates involved and I want to get my teammates going. But when you think about it, if anyone grew up like that, you'd always be score first, or you'd always be like, I'm going to throw the ball when it looks good to my teammates. And I think that's kind of how D'Lo probably played his entire life. So it's just what comes natural to him on the court. And I'm wondering if that's something that can be shifted, because I do think earlier in the year, in the first couple of games, and maybe this was just because it was a new team for him and he was trying to kind of find his footing, I think he was a little bit better about getting other guys involved early in the offense and kind of getting the ball moving.
I think it goes back to the accountability that I mentioned could be an issue once Jeremy Lin went down, that Lin would command the respect of D'Lo and have another ball handler with him that he could take the pressure off him and say, hey, let me run the offense for a little bit. And you have to get your teammates involved more. But now with D'Lo being the main guy, he's kind of going to run roughshod around the whole operation. I mean, who's going to be there to say, let me take a chance and let me be the main initiator of this set? So I think 25-year-old D'Lo might be able to get it. But now he's 21 years old. And as you mentioned, he might not really know how to kind of occupy that pass and score balance at this point.
You are listening to Locked On Nets, your Locked On Podcast Network, Brooklyn Nets podcast, bringing you Nets content 3 to 5 times a week. It's the only place you can get consistent audio breakdowns of the Brooklyn Nets from me and Josh. And I highly encourage you to check out the entirety of the Locked On Podcast Network. We have a podcast for every NBA team, every NFL team, and we're doing some big things at the Locked On Podcast Network. Again, we're going to continue to talk about those as the podcast goes forward, but I'm really proud of where the network's going and where it's been. Yeah, Josh, I think that's a pretty prudent point that D'Lo is only 21. You look at someone like Dinwiddie, I can't say I religiously followed his career before the season, but who knows, maybe it took him a while to kind of develop that same mentality, and now he has it at age 24, and maybe he didn't have it at age 21, and just, sorry about that, and yeah. And just,
it wouldn't be a podcast without Gavin's video going up.
No, because you know what? You know what, Josh? Like, you want to go inside baseball, go inside baseball. We're Skyping. I have to keep the volume on my computer for it to record. And whenever I open a link on ESPN, a video is inevitably going to be
popping. Well, you should mute the videos beforehand. It does it for all the ESPN.
I can't because I know that, but like I look up the article. I mean, I look up stuff as we go and I improvise a little bit.
Okay, you can tweet us either Gavin Wright or Josh Wright, who you agree with in this podcast.
I expect thousands of responses on this. Yeah, I'm team Gavin Wright, by the way, if that wasn't clear.
I think I'm team Gavin Wright also.
Okay, good. All right, I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm just saying, yeah, maybe that's a mentality that takes a long time to develop, but then you see guys who never really get that balance, and those are the guys who kind of flame out. Obviously, Derrick Rose is a guy who I think kind of plays like that, and he also dealt with some major injuries, so it's hard to put it entirely on that. Tyreek Evans is a guy who I think kind of plays like that, and he's kind of having a renaissance in Memphis, but he never lived up to his exactly
career.
And he's someone who peaked early in his career. Yeah, no, I'm trying. Can you think of guys on the other side of that who started their career like not totally knowing that balance and then figuring out? Because I think of guys like Chris Paul, Mike Conley, like even from their rookie year, they were very, very good in those areas. Maybe a James Harden, but he was a sixth man, so it was just like a different situation.
Yeah, I think it definitely depends on what situation you're in, especially as a high draft pick. I mean, when you look at Russell's second overall pick on the Lakers team with Byron Scott that first year, that kind of had no clue what to do. And he was asked to be the entire franchise for them. And basically the team didn't care about wins and losses. If he was putting up 20, 25 a game, they only cared about Kobe Bryant and his retirement tour. So there wasn't really that sense of accountability from a young age. But I think you have to hope that Kenny Atkinson and his staff are able to preach that to D'Lo, and it's only been 8 games this season. And I think that we're being very negative on this podcast, but Spencer Dinwiddie's improvement has just been insane. His 3-point shot looks so much better than it was last year, and not just spotting up, just confidently stepping into long threes off the dribble. And that's one of the most important qualities in a lead ball handler. And he's looking like he's the real deal. I'm really happy he's under contract at the minimum for both this year and next year. A really good defender also, and someone that really just gets the team moving, and the team just seems to play better when he's out there on the court. So he's been such a pleasant surprise for me this year. We hyped him up in summer league as someone that was going to be a very competent backup, and he's looking like he could be a starting caliber player for the foreseeable future.
All right, yeah, so having said that, where do you see him fitting into this rotation going forward? I think we both agree that he needs to play more minutes. He's only been averaging 23 a game on the season, and that's obviously boosted from that Cleveland game when D'Lo was out. He played 32. I'd be surprised if he doesn't start kind of hovering up to that like 27, 28, 29 range, which again for Kenny Atkinson is a really big deal with how he likes to rotate those guards in and out. But do you think it's a possibility that he could maybe start alongside D'Lo, replace him a little bit earlier? Where do you see that going?
I think that the starting is always going to be tough because Atkinson doesn't really trust Isaiah Whitehead or even Sean Kilpatrick, Caris LeVert to be the point guard. So one of Dinwiddie or D'Lo has to be on the court at all times, but I'd definitely like to see them playing more together. Dinwiddie only played 9 minutes in the first half yesterday, which is an abomination because he's been a top 4 player on the team, along with D'Lo, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, and Damari Carroll. Whichever order you would have those 4 players, you can make a case for either of them 1 through 4. But I think that he's someone that needs to be up at that 28, even 30-minute a game range. And D'Lo needs to be as well. So if that's the case, then they're going to be overlapping for 10 to 12 minutes a game regardless.
Yeah. No, I've loved everything he's brought to the table. I would play him 30 minutes a game. And I continue to experiment and kind of see how you can prod D'Lo into the right directions. But I think, I mean, just given how poor this team has been the last 3 games, I kind of wanted to take a shot at myself quickly, which I'm sure will delight you, Josh. And just into, I think the biggest thing And this, you could say this for NBA rookies, probably young NBA coaches. And I think young people who cover the NBA too, the biggest thing you have to learn is perspective. And I know you get on me sometimes for this, and our friend of the show, Marcus Barahal, probably gets on me for continually switching my opinion back and forth on Frank Ntilikina. And you kind of overreact to small sample sizes. And I was like, singing the praise of this team, singing the praise of Sean Marks, which I still stand by largely. But then they go and lose three in a row. And like, and again, when you're dealing with eight-game sample size, suddenly we go from, oh, wait, D'Lo could be an all-star to like, Jesus Christ, he does not fit in with this team. He's never going to be a productive player. Is he ever going to turn around and help these guys, which I was literally talking about 5 minutes ago. So again, you got to look at larger sample sizes and maybe wait 30, 40 games to draw larger conclusions. But then when you're doing like 3 to 5 podcasts a week, I think it's natural to like have takes at the time. So I'm not 100% sure where I'm going with this, Josh, and whether or not I'm justifying having hot takes, different hot takes every week, or whether I should be extremely cautious and say nothing of significance each and every podcast. But I guess what I'm prioritizing is both for us, for the Nets, and for people who follow them, have some perspective and wait a little bit before you freak out or get too excited.
So I shouldn't say my take that the Allen Crabb trade was worse than the KG Paul Pierce trade.
No, I knew that was coming, or something similar to that was coming. So that's specifically why I said that now, to preface that. So why don't you go in for that? And why don't we throw caution to the wind and you can tear apart Allen Crabb to your heart's content?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm joking with that. But the Allen Crabb trade has been an absolute abomination. He's been terrible. His 3-point percentage is down to 35%, and that's okay, but not for someone whose only job is to shoot threes. Exactly. He does take a lot of high degree of difficulty shots, but the guy cannot do anything. And there was one play last night where Damari Carroll was basically standing at the basket, and he had gotten the ball at around midcourt. And there was 3 Suns players about his level, and obviously, as I mentioned, Carroll was right at the basket waiting to receive the pass for a layup. And Crabb just took 3 dribbles and taking his sweet old time, and by the time he passed it to Carroll, the layup was able to be contested. And that just shows the lack of basketball awareness. The guy is incapable of doing anything besides shooting threes. And a lot of Nets fans thought that he was going to be able to really expand his game under Kendi Atkinson. And Sean Marks, obviously, he signed into that offer sheet with the Blazers in the summer of 2016. So after that, after watching for another year, he took another chance on him. Clearly, he saw something in this guy, but right now we're just not seeing it. And to not get another asset with Crabb's horrible contract, I know that we were able to get rid of Andrew Nicholson, but it really hampers the Nets' flexibility in the future, because Crabb right now is dead weight, and he's doing not even replicating what Joe Harris is doing on like a 20th of the salary. So it's disappointing to watch.
Yeah, the shooting isn't really my main concern. I'm more with you that the lack
of everything else,
diversity in his game, I think that's going to turn around at some point. But again, that's if you're one trick pony and that one trick isn't working, you don't really have any value. And that's been the case as of late. Crabb against the Suns, 5 points, 2 of 10 from the field, 1 of 7 from 3-point range. And over his last 5 games, this is from Brian Lewis of the New York Post, or I probably could have looked it up myself too, scored 38 points over the last 5, shooting just 13 of 45 from the field. So probably just a hair under 30%, which obviously is not spectacular. I think some of those threes are going to start dropping. He's going to have a couple of games where he scores over 20 just on a high volume. But he needs to.
I think the biggest concern is that we haven't seen any indication that he's going to be able to diversify his offensive game. Either he can't run a pick and roll. He's not really great in transition. The only thing he can do is just take that spot up three. And when he's attacking a closeout, he's pretty limited. Had a couple plays this year where he was able to make a nice mid-ranger or take it to the basket, but it's not going to happen with any sort of frequency.
Yeah. I believe in Kenny Atkinson's ability to develop players more than a good chunk of coaches in the league. So I'd even go as far as to say give it a season.
But what would he do to kind of justify that salary?
He'd have to shoot over 40% from three, average like 16 to 18 points a game, and again, add in like a little bit of playmaking and scoring 2 or 3 times a game off the dribble where guys really crash on his three-point shooting or creating a basket for his teammate. And as you said, we haven't seen that so far, and I don't think that's asking too much. And again, it just all depends on like whether or not he has it in him. Like, I'm sure he's working his ass off to get all of that done. But we're going to see. And I think if we're not seeing signs of that by the second half of the season, then you might be right. And this was a pretty bad deal for the Nets. But let's give it some time.
Yeah, I do have to give Crabbe some credit because in the fourth quarter of last night's game, he had one or two possessions where he was guarding Devin Booker and actually did a good job of contesting and making sure that Booker didn't get an easy look off. So it seemed like he was motivated there. Just need to see that defensive intensity for all the time he's on the court, not just the last few minutes. Because even though Booker, he was able to contain Booker for those possessions, TJ Warren was getting whatever he wanted. And so was guys like Mike James, Dragan Bender, basically everyone on the Suns team besides Josh Jackson, who was terrible.
Yeah, he was pretty atrocious.
He gave the Nets the comeback.
Yeah, he was helping you guys out quite a bit. We kind of touched on it at the beginning of the podcast, but did you have any thoughts on like the overall experience? Because this was, I think, only like my second or third ever Brooklyn Nets game. And the first time I've been in like 5 years. So I definitely had some thoughts on the experience.
Yeah, I mean, I go to a lot of games, so it's kind of all pretty standard for me. So I'd love to hear kind of what you thought as a newcomer to the experience.
Yeah. All right. As someone who's gone to maybe like 100 Suns home games over the last 4 years, the biggest thing for me right off the bat, and I guess depending on what city you're in, this might seem like a huge deal or not a big deal at all, the fact that the seats are cushioned was like amazing, because the Suns is just like hard seats and your back is hurting you the whole game and you're like dying to get up. But here I was cool just like sitting forever and like,
it's New York. We're not
enjoying basketball. Yeah. No, I know. But it was just, it honestly makes such a big difference in Phoenix. Like if the game's not close, I'm like kind of dying to get out. It's like I'm uncomfortable and cramped. And then that's, I'm just lounging out, relaxing, having a good old time. So that was good. The halftime show was just like standard NBA fare. It was like guys dancing.
I don't remember what it was.
No, it was like, remember the chubby devil won the dancing competition? Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny.
He was pretty compelling.
We went with a big group of people, so there's a lot of people to talk to when the game wasn't going on.
Yeah,
so
which always helps.
Kind of was in and out of the halftime festivities.
Yeah, I'll say I like the standard, I know the Suns do this too, shoot a layup, free throw, three-pointer, and half-court shot for money. Because as I mentioned, I'm very convinced that I could win that. So I'm definitely, I always kind of lock into those. That was a lot of fun. I liked the in-game music. I don't know if it was like, if I'd quite compare it to like what the Hawks have going on, but there was like a good mix of like hip hop and stuff. And I'm always like really fascinated like how much they cater that to like the home team, because I don't think there's any other level of basketball really where they play music during games, like while like the actual action's going on, and like whether they go up to like guys and like D'Lo and be like, hey, do you like this beat when you have the ball, or do you like this beat, or like what gets you motivated and going? Because I know when I'm just shooting around, I play a little bit better and I play a little bit faster when I have my headphones in. So I'm wondering how they do that for each guy, and then whether they try and like flip that when the Nets are on defense.
Yeah, you know, I've never thought of that.
I put a ton of thought into that.
Good insight into your psyche, Gavin.
Yeah, just a lot of randomness. But that's always been kind of interesting for me. And I generally liked how the Nets did it. I'm trying to think if there was anything else. We did pass up on an opportunity to buy $10 game-worn Luis Scola socks for one of our best friends who's from Argentina. So that was my big regret from the game.
Well, you weren't there for that.
I missed it, but I could have gone
to the VIP lounge earlier than you.
That's true. But
let's not bore the listeners with this inside baseball talk.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. I just wanted everyone to get a gist for what our experience was like. Overall, all in all, I had a good time, and I'm planning on kind of making the Nets my new Suns, and that their tickets are much cheaper than the Knicks. And I'd like to go to like 10 home games this year. It was a good time.
Yeah, I'm not going to call you out, but you're rooting for the Suns extremely passionately. And I was sitting next to you and I was absolutely dismayed by your behavior, especially when the Nets were getting killed in the second quarter and the start of the third.
All right, I'll clarify that the volume of my cheering was mostly just to annoy you. But
I was annoyed.
But I'm a capital J journalist. There's no bias.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were in section 226 last night, and there was a crazy rabid fan that was living and dying by every shot. You have just met me in person, so congratulations.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you had some good lines. You're getting the people going around us. Just a reminder, if you haven't done so yet, take a minute and leave a 5-star review for Locked On Nets. It really does help. Thank you for taking the time. Josh, I'd love to hear, well, first, your boss player of the game, I assume Spencer Dinwiddie. I don't think we really have to go into that.
Yep, you nailed it on the head. He was great, knocked down some threes, really got the team back into it. And apparently he got Ian Eagle going at home. We missed the call, but I was heard from many of my friends that he was going crazy when Dinwiddie led that run to give the Nets that lead.
Yeah, I might go back and watch the third quarter specifically for that purpose. But Josh, what about the game? Game experience, let me say, grinding your gears.
Certainly. So I love all the people at Barclays. The vendors have always been very friendly and helpful. But when we're coming back with food, and I went with chicken tenders and fries, and obviously I was a little disappointed by the big decision. Disappointed by kind of the amount of food I was getting for the price, but hey, that's any New York area stadium. So when I'm walking into section 226, upper level, and someone asked me for my ticket, this is not the section I would be sneaking into, trust me. There's no reason why I would ever try to sneak into an upper level section. I even said to the woman, trust me, this is not, if I was trying to sneak in somewhere, this would not be it, because it's just ridiculous. I'm in the stadium, so clearly I have a ticket. And I'm getting the worst seats in the house. I'm having my food. I don't want to drop it. Just, let me go. You know what? It's not, we're not trying to sneak into the first row of a Yankee Stadium game. Just let it happen, you know?
Yeah. And here's the thing. Even if hypothetically you had a ticket to a different section, and as you said, you obviously had a ticket because you were there.
Right.
Would that really be an issue when every single section is half empty? That you're trying to go sit with your friends and you just happen to end up in different sections, would that like demonstrably affect your life? And look, let me say, like, I know this woman was just trying to do her job and she's probably instructed to do that. So it's not on her. It's a ridiculous policy. And I kind of get it because like people do try and sneak in, but again, it's a completely different story.
Just not there.
If you're in the lower bowl. Yeah, exactly. And by the way, if you ever want to sneak into the lower bowl, the move is to never make eye contact. Walk straight, walk confidently. If they call you once, don't stop. If they call you twice, then you should probably
It's like when I walk into your building and I go
Don't
I get called up by the doorman.
Oh, 100%. It's literally all about confidence. You're confident. You look like you know where you're going. People are unlikely to bother you. And also always wait until they're engaged with another person. They don't want to break up that conversation, especially to yell at you twice. So that's my final tip of the game. We'll be back to break down the Nets' West Coast road trip and probably react to that first Lakers game, which is in two nights.
Friday.
Yeah. Maybe we'll do another pod tomorrow, or we'll come back after the game. But any quick thoughts on that Lakers game? I think it's going to be cool to kind of see how D'Lo performs, given like not that he faced like rampant criticism after last night, because I don't think. Like people looked at that stat line and like wanted to really attack him, but
besides John Schumann, who said that he'd rather have Mike James over D'Lo.
Oh yeah, that was pretty good. But yes, outside
which
of
I agreed with until I cooled down today.
Yeah. I'm happy. If we had recorded last night, this would have been like we would have been saying a lot of the same stuff, but it would have been like a lot more bombastic and with a lot less qualifiers. But that's gonna be a big game for him, given how he's played recently. I want to see if he can kind of toggle his game to be more team-oriented, and even more importantly, like this Lakers team that traded him away and called him, now it's looking like it might have been accurate, not a leader. What does he do against them? And what does he do against Lonzo, his replacement?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see if he can get going against Lonzo. It definitely is a favorable matchup for him, but we said the same thing about Mike James. I think Brook Lopez isn't playing too many minutes for the Lakers right now, which is kind of surprising. I think he only played 18 last game. But he definitely is a tough matchup for the Nets big men, who are very slow getting out to the perimeter. So he could have a good game, as is Julius Randle off the second unit. So hopefully that Quincy Acey or Jared Allen will be back. So we don't really have to see too much Tyler Zeller, who did an admirable job, but isn't an impact player whatsoever. So if Acey's back, that will add a nice dimension with his three-point shooting and Allen with his rim protection. So if we see that, I think the Nets will hopefully bounce back and just give a better effort, even if it doesn't result in a win. You want to see the process continue to improve and the players show that they are improving game by game.
Yeah, I think not to harp too much on that D'Lo point, but yeah, what's so interesting to me is like I think his instinct, like everything in his body is going to be screaming, go out there and drop 40 on Lonzo. And I think he's totally capable of doing it. But I think Kenny Atkinson is going to be telling him to do the exact opposite. So this is... This is going to be good TV, I guess, is my concluding point. And we'll let you know how it goes. For Josh, I'm Gavin. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Locked On Nets. Again, the new place to find us is Panoply, but if you have the podcast downloaded, it shouldn't affect you either way. So we'll sign off for now and talk to you on Friday. All right.